From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the Thai military take control of the country in a coup the US says has no justification.
We call on them, of course, to immediately restore democracy and civilian rule. We're trying to make contact with Thai military leaders at this point in time.
Also today, Russia and China veto a UN bid to refer Syria to the International Criminal Court. And 1 year on, the British soldier murdered in a brutal terrorist attack is remembered.
Turned to the direction of the voice, and my eyes met two bloodied hands, one carrying a bloodied revolver and the other one a bloodied meat cleaver and butcher's knife. By then I was looking at him and I said, why? He said, because he's a British soldier and I killed him.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The U.S. government has formally recognized the military coup and suspension of the constitution in Thailand, expressing disappointment and concern over the news. The State Department warned the move will have negative implications for the U.S.-Thai relationship. Washington correspondent Alice Olstein has the latest on U.S. reaction to the crisis.
More than 7 hours after the Thai military took power from the civilian government in a self-described coup, the U.S. State Department released a statement calling for an immediate return to democracy, respect for human rights and press freedoms, and early elections. State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki told reporters in Washington, what happens now?
We've taken preliminary steps to suspend military engagement and assistance while we consider the facts on the ground.
The State Department is not currently urging Americans to evacuate Thailand, but vowed to keep them updated on safety developments.
The United Nations Security Council has imposed sanctions against Nigerian Islamist militant group Boko Haram. The terrorist group is behind the recent kidnapping of hundreds of schoolgirls and waves of deadly bombings across the country. Nigeria's representative to the UN requested Boko Haram be added to the list of Al-Qaeda-linked organizations facing sanctions. Boko Haram now faces an asset freeze and arms embargo. At least 14 Ukrainian soldiers were reportedly killed after armed militants attacked a checkpoint in the Volnovakha area in eastern Ukraine on Wednesday night. According to reports, at least 4 checkpoints were ambushed just 3 days before presidential elections are due to take place in Ukraine. Anya Ardaeva reports from Moscow.
The country's interim prime minister, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, has called for an emergency session of the UN Security Council and said Russia was involved in the latest violence. Russian President Vladimir Putin earlier announced troops withdrawal from Russia's border with Ukraine, easing concerns about a military intervention.
U.S. law enforcement agents must now record all interviews with suspects. That's the word from the Department of Justice in a reversal of a policy that's been in place for decades. Agents at the Federal Bureau of Investigations, the U.S. Marshals, and the Drug Enforcement Agency are among those affected. Also in the U.S., a man accused of holding a young woman hostage for 10 years has been charged in a California court on counts including rape, molestation of a minor, and kidnapping. His victim says she was 15 when Isidro Garcia kidnapped her, then forced her into marriage and motherhood. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The United Nations Security Council has failed to pass a resolution that would have referred the conflict in Syria to the International Criminal Court. Russia and China both vetoed the vote. Nick Harper has more from UN headquarters in New York.
When the 15 members of the Security Council raised their hands to vote, there were no real surprises. The vote was fully expected to fail. Indeed, the day before, Russia's representative to the UN, Vitaly Churkin, confirmed he would veto, calling the vote a publicity stunt. But to publicly force Russia to show its hand was a move aimed at further demonstrating its isolation on the Council. The Security Council has twice before referred conflicts to the ICC, Darfur in 2005 and Libya in 2011. Nick Harper, New York.
And Russia's deputy ambassador to London has met with UK Foreign Office officials over Prince Charles's alleged comments comparing Vladimir Putin to Hitler. The heir to the British throne reportedly made the comparison on a royal tour of Canada. In a conversation about Adolf Hitler's takeover of Eastern European countries when leader of Nazi Germany, Deputy Ambassador Alexander Kramarenko met with Foreign Office officials for clarification. But as Ollie Barrett reports from London, he appears to have received little of that.
The Foreign Office says the official who met Ambassador Kramarenko could not be expected to comment on reports of private conversations. And their conversation developed, says the Foreign Office, into an urging by the UK that Russia should step back from comments or actions that could destabilise Ukraine ahead of this weekend's elections. A spokesman for the Russian embassy earlier called Prince Charles's comments outrageous, and the Russian Foreign Ministry said it agreed with one British Labour politician who'd insisted royalty should be seen and not heard.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Thailand's military has declared a coup and taken control over the national government. The army chief said military rule would help a country, pounded by months of political turmoil, return to normal quickly. Washington was swift to react, with the US Secretary of State insisting there was no justification for the military coup and warning of negative implications for US-Thai relations. John Kerry also stressed his concern over reports that senior political leaders had been detained and that media outlets had been shut down, urging the swift return to democratic rule. Tim Newton is a journalist in Phuket, Thailand, and he spoke to me earlier.
Well, this isn't the first coup that's been brought about by the army to sort out political problems in Thailand. In fact, this will be the 11th military coup since 1932, when democratic government was first introduced to Thailand. So it's not a huge surprise. Indeed, it's only 2 days ago that the military initiated martial law. But I think a lot of people suspected that a full military coup was just around the corner.
So the head of the army says he's seizing power. What does that mean for the people of Thailand and for the many tourists and expats in the country, like yourself?
Well, General Prayut Chan-o-cha has been very quiet for the past 6 months, basically saying that the army are not going to intervene. And it's been expected that at some time they would, because in the past 6 months there have been 28 people killed in protests between anti-government and pro-government protesters out on the streets, and another 200 injured. So I think a lot of people are saying, gee, it's about time this happened. Something had to break the stalemate. The government, the constitutional courts, all the advisors, nobody could find a solution, a democratic way through. It's been a complete impasse. Only a month ago, the caretaker Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra was stood down by the Constitutional Court over a rice pledging scheme, which has just been one of the many controversies of the government. So we really had a political vacuum with caretaker Prime Minister after another caretaker Prime Minister, the protests continuing on the streets, and no solution to be found. So I think most Thai people, the expats and the business community here in Thailand, are saying it's about time this happened. And as far as people are concerned walking on the streets of Bangkok tonight, or indeed the rest of Thailand, even here in Phuket, things are very quiet. You really wouldn't know that anything is happening. In Bangkok, there are army tanks rolling around the streets. There are the army who have got a very strong presence. But it is really business as usual. And the army have said quite implicitly that they want the tourists to come. They want the people of Thailand to be safe. They want to find some way forward.
So just to go back to the point you made, you're in Phuket, that's 600 miles away from the capital. You're not feeling anything. There is nothing has changed as far as you're concerned where you are.
No, nothing really has changed. The tourists down in the main little spot called Patong Beach, which is a huge tourist hotspot here in Southeast Asia, if they weren't turning on the TV or the radio, they would have no idea that there's a military coup, that there has been a complete military takeover of the government here in Thailand. And as I say, I repeat, the government's made it very clear they want business as usual. They want Thai people to go to their offices tomorrow. They want the public service to turn up. I should mention, however, even down here in Phuket, we, who run a radio station here called Live 89.5 and a TV station, Phuket News TV, have been asked to switch to the Army channel, Channel 5, and not broadcast our normal programs. So we are feeling the effects from the point of view of being able to turn on our TV and just seeing the military Channel 5, which has just got a gentleman sitting down in front of a very boring beige background reading the news from the Army General. We have volunteered to just turn our transmitter to the Army Channel 5, I suppose more just to protect ourselves. We haven't been given any specific directions. We're just following the lead from other broadcasters around us. There aren't a lot of English-speaking broadcasters. We're just trying to be responsible people living here. We are guests of this country, so we don't want to ruffle any feathers. But, of course, we do want to report what's happening here in Thailand. But we can report that pretty much on the streets it's peaceful. There's nothing to worry about. And as the general and the army keep on saying, they want the tourists to keep on coming. And the people here in Thailand, they are, as I mentioned earlier, used to these military coups. They come and they go. They're relatively peaceful. And at some stage, we imagine the next 2 or 3 months, there will be democratic elections called. Once everybody's settled down, and I suppose the army have some agreement between the political players that they're going to play fair.
Tim Newton in Thailand. This is FSN Reports. The United Nations Security Council has failed to pass a resolution to refer the conflict in Syria to the International Criminal Court. Russia and China both vetoed the move, but that was widely expected long before the delegates raised their hands confirming their no vote. FSN's UN correspondent Nick Harper joined me from the UN headquarters in New York, and I began by asking him about the aim of this resolution.
Well, this was a draft resolution that was put forward by France, but also supported by another 64 countries. The idea being to refer the conflict in Syria to the International Criminal Court. It's something that the Security Council has done before. They've referred the problems in Darfur in 2005 to the ICC, and they did the same with Libya in 2011. But this is the first time that a Security Council vote for an ICC referral has failed.
But the vote wasn't expected to pass, was it? So why did they hold the vote?
Well, yes, this is the strange thing. Going into the vote, everyone knew that it wasn't going to pass. China and Russia have 3 times in the past both vetoed draft resolutions on Syria. This was their 4th time. And even on Wednesday, before the vote even happened, the representative for Russia, Vitaly Churkin, said that he would definitely veto, and he called the whole vote a publicity stunt. So you might question, why exactly go ahead with a vote when you know it's not going to happen? And I guess many diplomats would say that it gives an opportunity to very publicly show, and on the record show, the position of those two countries. And it also shows their isolation amongst the other members on the council and many other countries who feel that the Syrian conflict should be referred to the ICC as a way of trying to have some sort of progress in the more than 3-year conflict.
And Nick, what did the countries have to say about this?
Yes, some very strongly worded statements from the representatives afterwards. In particular, Samantha Power, the US representative to the UN, she said that China and Russia should both themselves now be held accountable.
While there may be no ICC accountability today for the horrific crimes being carried out against the Syrian people, there should be accountability for those members of this council that have prevented accountability.
However, China's ambassador, Wang Ming, speaking through a translator, gave this as his main reason for not supporting the vote.
To forcibly refer the situation of Syria to ICC is neither conducive to building trust among all parties in Syria or to the early resumption of the negotiation in Geneva. It will only jeopardize the efforts made by the international community to push for the political settlement.
And Russia's representative, Vitaly Churkin, said that the West should abandon their futile dead-end policy of endlessly escalating the Syrian crisis.
The draft resolution rejected today reveals an attempt to use the ICC to further inflame political passions and lay the groundwork in the end for eventual outside military intervention.
So another vote, another veto, and once again the Security Council has failed to find a unanimous voice on Syria. The Assistant Secretary General Jan Eliasson said as a result, the credibility of the Council and the entire organisation, the UN, would now suffer.
Nick Harper at the UN headquarters in New York. Now, it's exactly a year since a soldier was hacked to death on a London street by two British converts to Islam. Fusilier Lee Rigby was targeted near a barracks in southeast London by Michael Adebolajo and Michael Adebowale, both in their 20s. Adebolajo was given a whole life term and Adebowale jailed for 45 years. But calls for a permanent memorial to Lee Rigby in Woolwich have been rejected by local politicians, who fear it would attract extremists. Reporter for Britain's LBC Radio, Tom Swarbrick, looks back on that day 1 year ago in southeast London.
On this spot, on the corner of an ordinary street on a bright spring day, a blue Vauxhall Tigra with two young men inside lurched across the road and slammed into the back of an off-duty soldier. The two men got out of the car, withdrew several knives and a meat cleaver, and hacked at the motionless body. Where were you on the 22nd of May? James was here, and he saw it. This is what he told LBC.
Got on the phone to the police, 999. I've called them, I said, you need armed response, you need police, you need someone here. These two guys are chopping this guy to pieces.
What was this? Was it gang-related? Was it drug-related, perhaps? All too viscerally, all too calmly, an explanation. The killer, blood covering his hands, spoke to a man on a bus, filming it on his phone, and told the world why.
The only reason we have killed this man today is because Muslims are dying daily by British soldiers.
But even in the darkness of this attack, even as the killers circle round their victim, decency was still visible even in this abyss. A woman old enough to be the young soldier's mother walked towards his body, now lying in the middle of the road, lay down next to him, and began to offer any comfort she could. She was an angel of Woolwich. Her name is Ingrid Lawyer Kennett.
Turned to the direction of the voice, my eyes met two bloodied hands, one carrying a bloodied revolver and the other one a bloodied meat cleaver and butcher's knife. By then I was looking at him and I said, why? He said, because he's a British soldier and I killed him.
It's now been 10 minutes since the attack first happened. It must have felt longer. The police arrive. Shots were fired. The men fell just here by these trees. Some shots missed and hit the wall here. The bullet holes still remain. It was just after that I arrived. There were hundreds of people out on the streets. There was police tape billowing everywhere. That night, someone, indeed the Prime Minister no less, mentioned the T word, terrorism. It wasn't until the next day that we had a name and a photo and a grieving mother and a two-year-old boy now fatherless, Lee Rigby. His family bereft and only just able to fight back tears, spoke.
I just want to say that I love Lee. I always will. And I'm proud to be his wife. He's due to come up this weekend. So we could continue our future together as a family. He was a devoted father to our son Jack. And we'll both miss him terribly.
How do you describe what happened here? How do you reconcile with it? Was this an act that transcended your average criminal behaviour, or was it more sinister? Does the fact that it was motivated by a political and religious ideology make it worse? Or perhaps just the barbarism of the act itself? However you feel about it, however you remember it, it's hard to forget what happened here.
Correspondent with Britain's LBC Radio, Tom Swarbrick. Finally tonight, FSN Spotlight, the segment of the show that takes an in-depth look at a story you might have missed. With today's edition, Simon Marks.
On FSN Spotlight, a more detailed look at the European elections, which got underway today. They're taking place in 28 countries between now and Sunday, and up for grabs are 751 seats in the European Parliament in Strasbourg. Turnout is expected to be low. There's a general lack of interest across Europe in the inner workings of the European Parliament, but far-right parties in several countries may perform strongly, because their voters are determined to show up at the polls and express their hostility towards the growing federalisation of Europe. Peter Spiegel is the Brussels bureau chief for the Financial Times, and he previewed the elections in a conversation with the newspaper's foreign affairs commentator, Gideon Ruckman.
If you would talk to people in Brussels, there are some quarters who say that perhaps we are paying too much attention to it. And they make the argument that, you know, even the worst case scenarios, we're talking maybe 30% of the parliament will be Eurosceptic. The two big mainstream parties, the center-left socialists and the center-right European People's Party, will get between them somewhere in the neighborhood of 400 of the 750 seats. So clearly a vast majority will go to the mainstream parties. But when you start looking country by country, it is amazing. If you look at even the founding members of the EU, France, Italy, the Netherlands, all three of those countries are likely to have Eurosceptic parties finish first or second. Then you throw in the UK, you throw in Finland, you throw in Denmark. There's anywhere in the neighborhood of 10 to 12 countries where these parties could finish in first and second. So yes, in some parts of Europe, they don't exist. Some big countries like Spain and Poland, you're going to get no Eurosceptic parties, and that's why it's going to be kept to 30% overall. But in a huge number of major EU countries, you are going to get these parties finishing in first or second, or in some cases third place, and that is no doubt going to have an effect on the debate on Europe in those countries.
So, Peter, it looks like after the parliamentary elections, we'll be looking at a parliament still dominated by the centre-right and centre-left, who essentially agree in being in favour of deeper European integration, and then a very large group barracking them from the far-right and the far-left, united perhaps only by their dislike of the European Union.
Yeah, it's true. But one of the things, again, which I think we need to highlight is, while it's true that the vast majority in Parliament, in terms of passing legislation through Parliament, the vast majority will be these centrist parties. If you throw in the Liberals there, again, you're going to get well over 400, you know, even close to 450. But the question is, what impact do these countries have back in the home countries? Because let's remember, the European legislation is not just the European Parliament. The European Council, which is made of the member states, also has a huge impact. Look at the two or three countries where we've had a direct impact back home. You can look at Britain, you can look at the Netherlands, and you can look at Finland, where we've had Eurosceptic parties really doing quite well for some time now. You know, David Cameron in particular was the man who became leader of the Tory party, saying we shouldn't be banging on about Europe. And yet the rise of UKIP has forced him to promise a referendum in or out on EU membership. So it has a direct impact on UK policy. Similarly, Mark Rutte, the Prime Minister of the Netherlands, because of the rise of Geert Wilders, who is the head of the Freedom Party, they're sort of their anti-EU right-wing populist party, he has presented a 54-point policies that he doesn't believe that EU should participate in. And similarly, the Finnish government has gone through fits on a lot of these Eurozone bailouts because the Social Democrats, because they lost so many of their core voters to the True Finns, which is their populist party, the Prime Minister announced he was resigning just a couple weeks ago. So the point I think people need to realize is, yes, okay, we'll have the vast majority of the parliament here is going to be mainstream parties. But these guys now will have soapboxes at the European Parliament where they can project back into the member states. And if we take those countries as examples where they've had a huge impact, we could see that in a far greater number of EU countries. And that could really put a sort of sand in the dirt of the wheels here in Brussels.
Are we now having the background for a real institutional struggle between an assertive parliament and national leaders who are less and less inclined to play ball with them?
We've seen that already, and I think, as you say, it's going to get even worse. I mean, I think the biggest one is going to be the first one off the bat, the decision of who the European Commission president is going to be. Now, this idea of picking Spitzenkandidat, which is sort of lead candidates for all major parties, which, again, Tony moderated the debate in, this was very much an idea of the European parliamentary parties. The heads of state, particularly on the center-right, Angela Merkel and some of the rest, really did not like this idea because this takes this out of the hands of the leaders. Well, the choice of a European Commission president to replace José Manuel Barroso is, frankly, a joint decision. It is essentially nominated by the heads of state at the European Council and then approved by the European Parliament. Well, what happens if the European Parliament says we must go with one of these Spitzenkandidaten, whichever party becomes the largest in the new parliament, and the heads of state say, well, actually, we want one of the prime ministers to be the new head of the European Commission. We could have weeks, if not months, of standoff. And there is, I must say, if you talk to both sides at this point, you get incredibly differing answers about how this is going to proceed. The folks on the European Council side said, of course, the heads of state will be picking. And if you talk to the parliament, they say, of course, the parliament will be picking. And so we could have an institutional standoff from the very beginning. So, yes, I think this is going to be a predominant feature of the EU as we go forward.
Yeah, and Peter, we've talked about the aggregate effect of this populist surge, but obviously it's going to be more dramatic in some countries than in others. It strikes me that really the big one is France. I mean, if you have the National Front, far-right party, coming top in France, you know, a state which, along with Germany, has driven this whole process, is that in itself a crisis, regardless of the kind of institutional effects?
Now, you talk to French officials about this, and their argument is, it's not like Front National is about to become the first party in France. They had local elections just a few weeks ago, and they did well in some constituencies, won a mayor race here or there. But it's not like suddenly they are going to become either the first or second parties of France. This is not something that's going to have a direct impact in what is basically a two-party system inside France. But it is certainly a loss, a huge loss, for François Hollande and the Socialists. I mean, this is a man who just came to office 2 years ago, and his party is going to finish third behind the UMP and the Socialists. And they will become the largest populist party here in Brussels. They have tried to form alliances. They've campaigned together with the Dutch Freedom Party of Geert Wilders. Now, you know, whether nationalist parties who are by definition contained to their own nation can actually get along here in Brussels is something that a lot of people speculate about. But if you have Front National having double-digit seats here in Brussels and being able to talk back and project back into France, that is no doubt going to affect the debate inside France going into their own domestic election. So yes, I mean, that is going to be the one that everyone is watching. The other one I would just say, not the biggest country in the world, but one that we always watch here in Brussels, is Greece. We have now a coalition government that is finally beginning to turn itself around, but we're again likely to see the far-right Golden Dawn neo-Nazi party and the far-left Syriza. Syriza could finish first place. What happens if the far-left party finishes first place in Syriza and PASOK, which is again the traditional center-left party, basically is wiped out? Right now, the governing coalition is center-right New Democracy and center-left PASOK. Well, there's a lot of speculation that that could lead to collapse of the government. And suddenly, just at the time that Greece is finally turning itself around after 4 or 5 years of recession and Eurozone crisis, the government collapsed. And we see an anti-EU party become the largest party in Greece. So it's not just the bigs that people are watching here in Brussels. It's a lot of these small countries that could have a real strong impact and affect the broader European story as well.
And this may be a slightly frivolous way of looking at it, Peter, but the European Parliament's not been the most interesting institution to observe. If nothing else, it's going to become rather lively.
It is, and I must say that even those who have worked a long time in the European project here, there are some quarters that are wringing their hands with dismay, but there are some quarters who said this is the debate we should have been having for a long time. At last, the lament of sort of the European federalists for decades has been every European Parliament election is about domestic issues. There's no one voting on European issues. Well, you know what? They're finally voting on European issues, and they're going to have a parliament that's going to have to gauge on European issues. And so there are some people who would consider themselves not federalists necessarily, but champions of the European project, who actually welcome this debate, who are actually kind of finally think that there is, you know, a parliament that's going to see almost a grand coalition in government and an opposition who's against them and Eurosceptic. So not everyone is doom and gloom here. Some people think it could actually re-energize the European project to have that debate out there.
Peter Spiegel, Brussels bureau chief for the Financial Times, talking to the newspaper's Gideon Ruckman. You can read their coverage of the European elections and the results as they come in on the newspaper's website, ft.com. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks in Washington.
And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. Coming up on Friday, the return to ground zero for the microbiologist who first identified one of the world's most deadly viruses. That's Friday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone, with feature story news everywhere. Have a great evening. Goodbye.